This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we present a special interview with author and activist Naomi Wolf.
Naomi, author initially of The End of America, the main protagonist in the film The End of America, and now the author of a new book, Give Me Liberty, will tell us all how to be more active and how to give backbone to this next administration so that it rolls back some of the most nasty stuff that the Bush administration does, and so that we can again, hopefully, move toward democracy in this country.
Stay with us.
As listeners may know, we had an extraordinary couple of weeks in terms of administration officials, particularly Vice President Cheney, admitting they were part of what I call the torture program. They don't call it the torture program. They call it the enhanced interrogation program. But Cheney, in two or three interviews, actually took responsibility for waterboarding, said he had signed off on it, approved it, that he thinks that we did well in using it, and he signed off on that as well as the enhanced interrogation techniques. What I would call that is basically Cheney confesses to approving the torture program. You would think that there might have been like a major public reaction from it, that people would say, indict the guy, indict the guy, indict the guy. But as usual, there's only a few of us out there saying, indict the guy. The rest of them, and I have sad to say, a lot of human rights groups are saying, well, that's too much. Obama's not going to do it. They're sort of crying in their beer. Maybe we need a truth commission. I want to know, what kind of truth commission do we need when we have the Vice President of the United States confessing to a torture program? Well, don't ask me. It's as usual. You know, in some way, Michael, in this country, people can't, they've been so already cowed, they can't actually look at reality and say what it is. What it is the Vice President has now said, I waterboarded three people at my behest, at least, and a lot more probably. Even the damn Times the other day says, well, truth commissions take note. Truth commissions take note.
They don't even get that. All they got to do
I will
is
say
play
this,
the recording.
Scott Horton, who I've been debating forever on truth commissions or commissions of inquiry versus prosecution, has come around on Cheney. He said to me the other day, Michael, he ought to be indicted immediately.
Sure.
So I said to Scott, well, what about Rumsfeld? There was just a report from Levin and McCain and 25 Democratic and Republican senators saying they were involved in the so-called Rumsfeld techniques, Abu Ghraib and all that. Shouldn't they go there too? Scott hasn't gotten back to me on that, but it's clear there should be indictments. But that's only part of the Cheney story. There's another part that, of course, is very interesting, Michael. Cheney, of course, uses the term enhanced interrogation techniques, talks about all that. And someone brought up on our listserv or sent us something about one of the precursors who used these kind of techniques, so-called enhanced interrogation techniques. And who was that, Michael?
Well, it was Joseph Stalin. He issued a memo to the Central Committee of the Communist Party, over which he ruled in 1939. And on the occasion of Stalin's 129th birthday on December 21st of this year, the winter solstice, a friend of ours sent us a copy of the memo that Stalin sent around to all the people under him entitled On Applying Physical Pressure to Prisoners. And it's the damnedest thing, Michael. The same rationale that Stalin uses to justify torture, physical pressure, is the content of Cheney's confession.
And what is that?
He says it's legal. He says it's effective. He says we do it in self-defense. And it's moral. Stalin lays out the memo on why people should, under him, should go out and torture prisoners in self-defense of the Soviet Union.
Let's follow this. So we have Cheney, enhanced interrogation techniques. There's a step in between Stalin and Cheney, and that's Hitler, because Hitler also, and that's where the word comes from, enhanced interrogation techniques. So you have Cheney, then you go to Hitler with enhanced interrogation techniques. Hitler, of course, learned from Stalin. This is 39 when Stalin's issuing this. Hitler at that time is already in the process of applying him. And where did Stalin say he got it from, the use of physical force to enhance
interrogation techniques?
He
says he got it from the bourgeois democracies.
Say that again, Michael. Quote. Where did Stalin say he got it from?
The bourgeois democracies. They all use it, so we should use it.
And remember now, we interviewed on this program a guy named Darius Rajali, who wrote a book on torture and democracy. And he talks about how a lot of these techniques were actually developed by democracies. So you go from, now you have Cheney, back to Hitler, back to Stalin, and then where does it end up?
In Chicago.
Amazing, right? We cover Chicago torture conspiracies in current times, in the 80s and 90s, and today in the Chicago police station where they tortured all those men. And where does this go back to in the 1800s probably, or early 1900s? It goes back to Chicago developed enhanced interrogation techniques, the Chicago Police Department, right here at home.
It's full circle. It comes full circle, and it proves the point that you're always making, Michael, that no torture is permissible. No torture. It's against the human spirit.
Last point on Cheney, what I think is going on, and I've been asked this over the last couple of weeks, why is Cheney all of a sudden giving these statements?
Michael, I know the answer, and you know the answer, and I think what we're going to tell our audience is that they are anticipating that Bush will pardon them, and they can make a clean breast of it now because they'll have no consequences to it.
Well, there's two points going on. I mean, I think we're not 100% sure. That's certainly one point. There may be a controversy going on within the administration about whether to pardon everybody generically, give a pardon, you know, that just says anybody involved in the interrogation of detainees post 9/11, hereby pardoned, would include Bush, Cheney. Bush could do that. Whether that's legal or not, I would say it's not. But, of course, an American court will give me a lot of difficulty on that. It's no good in Europe, such a pardon.
Yeah.
They don't reckon, you can't pardon war crimes. You can't pardon torture. So in Europe, we could still get these guys. So one thing, there could be a controversy, and Cheney is trying to say to the administration and the president, look it. I'm taking the load on this. Pardon me. Or really what may be happening is there's pardons that are going to be expected sometime after January 1st. And he's putting forth not just that I did it, but the justification for it, like the Stalin justification. He's saying, and he's saying this, we knew nothing before. We had got our hands on Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. We got all this evidence from Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, but we only got it once we started using waterboarding. Yeah. So he's trying to put forth the justification. So when Bush does the pardons, Bush can say, look, whatever they did, it was in the best interests. See Cheney. So we have a few messages here. One is, don't be fooled by this business of commissions of inquiry or truth commissions. Our highest administration officials, they've admitted to being part of the torture program, insist that Obama appoint a special prosecutor, go to the center's website, see where you can do it, have it done. That's number one. Two, if there's pardons, don't lose hope. At least these guys won't be able to go to the Riviera anymore, because we're going to try and get these guys wherever they go in the world. Today, we're really excited to have a one-hour special with Naomi Wolf. Naomi, as you will recall, is the author of the path-breaking book, The End of America, in which she addresses 10 steps that societies use, dictators use, sometimes democracies, use to close a society and move it on a road to dictatorship or fascism. It was a critical and groundbreaking book. From that book, she went on. That book was made into a movie, The End of America, which is now playing around the country, here in New York and in other cities. She's just come out with a new book called Give Me Liberty, a handbook for American revolutionaries. What's great about this book is this book not only lays out how we went wrong in America, but really how to get it right. And it's really a call to citizen and even revolutionary action that every single person, activist or not, has to have. When you get that question, what can I do? This book will tell you how you don't have to be helpless, how you can actually take issues into your own hand and change America. It's critical, it's important, and Naomi Wolf is probably one of the more extraordinary interviews we've done here because of her energy and her ability to really articulate what can be done and what's wrong in a language that the entire country can relate to and understand.
Welcome back, Naomi.
Thank you, Heidi. I'm really happy to be here.
Well, we're excited because you've had so many wonderful new developments since we last talked. You have Give Me Liberty, the book that's come out recently, and The End of America, your film.
That's right.
Let's start with the book.
Sure, but before we begin, can I just apologize to your listeners for the morning when I had crazily and insanely gotten my wires crossed, so you all were expecting me, and I was not here.
No
so.
Problem. It did well just mentioning your name.
You know, that's what I said to Naomi when she came in. I said, we're expecting Naomi. Here's her book. Let's go through the table of contents. This is a great book.
Well, that's very kind.
So actually, we're going to use you now. We decided every show.
In absentia.
Whenever you want.
We're going to tell people Naomi is coming. But actually, your first book, it was, not you have many books, but your first book on this theme of really sort of a post-9/11 what's happening in America was called The End of America.
That's right.
And what it did is, and I remember saying that to you, is it really set out for a broader audience than we reach what you saw occurring in America. And you had this sort of 10 principles or 10 steps. And why don't you just give us a summary of that book? It became a bestseller. Mm-hmm. And then from that emerged the movie and mm-hmm. then this amazing handbook. So just talk about your thesis a little bit, Naomi.
Sure, I will. Just before I talk about the 10 steps, I want to say that while it's reached a lot of people, I could never have written it without help from you, Michael, and the Center for Constitutional Rights, and you guys at the National Lawyers Guild, Heidi, you and Marjorie, because I've been very, very lucky, and I think every American should have the opportunity, which is why I'm engaged in this work right now, of having the best of the best, meaning people like you and Marjorie and Michael, explain to me what the law is and what's at stake and what's going on in terms of the subversion of liberties. Because one real problem we have in America is that we need to defend liberty, but over the last 30 years or more and more of the tools we need in order to do so have been kind of aggregated by the powers that be out of the hands of citizens. And if you're not a lawyer, it's very hard to, you know, follow a lot of the developments anyway. So one of the things I'm trying to do is popularize the work that you all are doing so heroically in the front lines. So what's the thesis? And by the way, don't just send WBAI money. You've got to send the National Lawyers Guild and the Center for Constitutional Rights and the ACLU money as well, because they're our army. They're our generals in the front lines in this war against citizens. So the thesis of End of America, which I wrote last year, 2007, the beginning of it, you know, of the journey of thinking I did, was brought about by a friend of mine, Wendy Yeager-Hyman, who is the daughter of Holocaust survivors. And you and I have talked about this, Michael. She kept insisting that some of the themes and strategies we were seeing in the Bush years had happened in Germany in the early years of the 30s. And at first I thought that this was insanely extreme and I disregarded it. But she insisted that I read some history. And when I started actually reading the history, not of the later years, which we're all familiar with, 38, 39, 40, but the early years, 1930, 31, 32, when Germany was a parliamentary democracy with many political parties and many newspapers and human rights lawyers and celebrities and gay rights organizations, you know, a modern pluralistic state, though a fragile one, I saw what she was talking about, because a small group of people used the law to subvert the law. And there were so many parallels with tactics and strategies that I saw, everything from the way in the early 30s, the National Socialists, who are a minority party, used what historians now think is a hyped or trumped up terrorist attack on the parliament to intimidate parliamentarians into passing legislation that's very much like the Patriot Act, all the way to insisting that they disembowel their own constitution, give away their own powers to an increasingly strong executive or leader, which ushered in, you know, everything to come, and actual tactics and strategies, actual laws I saw reproduced. I mean, Clause 2 in the Enabling Acts.
The Enabling Acts in Germany.
In Germany, thank you, gave the state the power to read German citizens' mail and listen into their phone calls and open their telegrams, again, in the alleged interest of national security and the fight against terrorism.
Homeland security. They actually called it homeland security.
Exactly. There are so many things like this that jump off the pages. Heimat, homeland. You know, little things that are kind of creepily small but identical. The Nazis used to unload the coffins of the war dead at night, and we started to unload the coffins of the war dead at night. You look at Leni Riefenstahl's propaganda documentary, Triumph of the Will, and you see the Fuhrer descending in this plane and greeted by these uniformed masses, and he says, our mission must be accomplished, and then you compare that with, you know, the famous scene on the aircraft carrier, Mission Accomplished. And much more, you know, disturbing things like, I, as a Jew, you know, you kind of have this kind of, I think, collective memory about things that are familiar. And I remember reading about Dixie Chicks CDs being burned all over the South because the Dixie Chicks had said something critical of Bush. And Clear Channel which has close ties to the White House, had sponsored or supported these spontaneous CD burnings. And I'm thinking, well, that's weird. CDs don't burn. You know, and I was also thinking, like, where have I heard that before? Right. Well, of course, Goebbels in 1933 sponsored, quote unquote, spontaneous book burnings of books critical of the regime. So there were so many echoes. And then I read other accounts of other times and places where a would-be dictator, whether on the left or on the right, sought to close an open society or crush a democracy movement. So I looked at Mussolini in 1920, and he was the great evil pioneer of these strategies. And, of course, I looked at the Germans. Hitler studied Mussolini. Stalin studied Hitler. Hitler studied Stalin. They learned from one another. I looked at Stalin's Russia. Then I looked at East Germany in the 50s, Czechoslovakia in the 60s, Pinochet's coup in Chile in 73, the Chinese crackdown on the democracy movement in the 80s. And what I saw is that there is a blueprint. The blueprint has 10 steps, 10 classic steps, no matter whether you're on the left or the right, a fascist or a totalitarian. If you want to be a dictator, you always use these 10 steps. The 10 steps have been codified. They teach them at the School for the Americas here, you know, to help Latin American would-be dictators overthrow their own governments and torture their own citizens. And these 10 steps always work. It turns out to be quite simple to close down a democracy. It's quite difficult to sustain a democracy. And what really terrified me is that I had to face the fact that those 10 steps were being put in place by the Bush administration. So that is the thesis of End of America.
I'm sure you get attacked, or you have been probably, for saying, well, this isn't Germany in the 30s and the 40s. That was massive murder, killing, etc. But what you're really saying is that the way you closed down a democracy are these steps, and these are echoes of what happened in Germany and these other countries.
Yes, although I have to say I was attacked a lot less than I expected, because the evidence is so chilling when you look at these things side by side. Michael, it's for exactly that reason, I hope you'll appreciate this as a lawyer, that the rhetorical strategy I used in the book is very conservative, lowercase c, in the sense that I simply put the parallels side by side and let the reader conclude for him or herself.
Naomi, one of the things that we've been really impressed with is that in addition to the extensive research you conducted, you've been traveling around the country and speaking to Americans. And had that informed the work that you've done?
Well, you know, I spend a lot of time traveling and speaking to Americans for, you know, generally as part of my job. I knew the kind of danger Americans were in from doing the research that led me to these conclusions, and I knew from my knowledge of talking to people from all different backgrounds and walks of life that we were in greater danger because Americans aren't familiar with those signs. People all over the world, like I would talk to journalists in Latin America after I wrote an early article summarizing these 10 steps, and journalists in Argentina or Brazil know perfectly well the difference between publishing a newspaper in a closed society and publishing it in an open society. Same newspaper, right? But you know how far you're allowed to go. And what worried me about America and why I felt like I had to get out there, like, you know, really sound the alarm, is that Americans have been, until recently, quite naive about feeling protected by this bubble of democracy. They had, when I first began writing, I think that's changed now, Americans had a sense of, well, democracy will protect me, but I don't have to lift a finger to protect democracy. Or they had a sense of, it can't happen here. So all over the world, people in the developing world or people who had experienced dictatorship or real oppression would look at American legislation and go, oh my God, you're making it easier for your leader to declare martial law? Oh my God, you're okaying wiretapping of citizens. Don't you know what this leads to? And Americans were blithely like, well, it's, you know, it's done in the name of the war on terror. It, you know, if I have nothing to hide, you know, I can't get in trouble. Totally naive.
I think what is extraordinary, and then we'll get to the 10 steps.
Well, we've just said two of them.
Two of them. Okay. But when I see you go out there and talk to people, is, as Heidi said, you really went out to people. I mean, people who are just regular people who you gave this message to. And if anybody ever gets a chance to see you, they should go, because it's a mesmerizing inclusion. And people are sitting there. You look at the audience and they're just stunned by what you're saying. And so it's something that a lot of people don't do, and that you did it even before you wrote the book to get a sense of what was going on is quite remarkable.
Thank you. But just to update my experience with my fellow Americans on the road, after I wrote The End of America and after it came out again, I was expecting a lot of hostility or skepticism, but it was so moving to me, Michael. You know, we're in a bubble here in New York or on both coasts, just like people are in a bubble in red states, people are in a bubble in their own communities. And that divide and conquer thing, I talk about it in Give Me Liberty, we're very much divided from each other and we have stereotypes about each other. I was very moved on the road with Give Me Liberty to speak to audiences like I've never met before, in the sense of I'd be speaking to 800 or 1,200 people, you know, not just the usual crunchy granola Smith graduates who are my base, you know, but, you know, truckers, farmers, libertarians, evangelicals, conservatives, you know, middle class people, upper middle class people, working people, truly from all demographics, all of whom were there because they love liberty and they love the Constitution and because they're sensible enough to understand that there's something scary going on and to recognize putting the pieces together when they hear it. So I was very moved by how transpartisan this issue is. And it's also inspiring because I got a sense from the diversity of those audiences and the love that people across party lines have for the Constitution when these issues are explained clearly. I was hopeful that we can really create a transpartisan mass movement of citizens to restore our liberties. So thank you.
So let's run through, because we have your second book to get to, Give Me Liberty, and we have the film. Let's
what are the
run
10
through
steps?
The 10 steps.
All right. They're so scary. So the first is that if you want to close an open society, you always invoke a terrifying internal and external threat, and sometimes it can be a real threat. Many of the initial charges against people accused with great fanfare by the Justice Department in the early days of the quote-unquote war on terror evaporate, you know, once they get to a real courtroom. But there are no headlines about those.
No, that's what happened. I mean, we had the real threat.
Right.
And then we charged a whole mass of people, and a lot of those people never even went to trial. And
exactly.
It's still going on.
And it's still going on. We had this terrorist attack, and that's a real attack. But the government chose to hype and manipulate fear for its own reasons. And it's not necessary. If you look at Spain, for instance, a country that was also hit by a very bad terrorist attack, the same bad guys, they didn't react by terrifying their own citizens and stripping them of civil liberties. In fact, they tried those accused in
the regular,
regular courts and put the transcripts on the internet, these transcripts that are so dangerous that none of us, not even our journalists or our, you know, lawyers can see what they're going to be saying. You know, and you look at Pinochet, he hyped a real threat. There were armed insurgents, but then he created false documents to hype that threat. And again, this administration created false documents in the form of the yellow cake documents to terrify us into a false charge that we had to invade Iraq because they were allegedly getting uranium to build a nuclear bomb. That's scary stuff. The second thing you do is that you create a, and this is your bailiwick, all of you, you create a prison system outside the rule of law where torture takes place. And the state starts to legitimize torture. Many Americans didn't feel upset or personally distraught at first that there was this island, Guantanamo Bay, where the administration was claiming that it was outside the rule of law and that anything could be done to these people because they really felt like this was the other. But the study of history shows how dangerous that is, because always what happens is a would-be dictator starts by torturing or abusing people who are seen as at the margins of civil society. In Germany, torture was illegal when the SA started to grab people and take them to these makeshift torture cellars. But who did they start with? Anarchists, communists. And people were like, whatever. You know, they knew about it. But then they moved on to closer and closer to the heart of civil society, homosexuals, Jews. People were still like, I don't care. It's the other. But then there was this one month in April of 1933 when the SA rounded up people at the heart of civil society. And it's always the same cast of characters at this stage. Opposition leaders, labor leaders, outspoken clergy, and journalists and editors. And once that happened, civil society structures were still in place, but everyone went silent. And you see that step again and again once torture is legalized. And a challenge I put to my audiences is, and maybe you guys have an answer, but no one else has yet, can you name a state that has legalized torture that did not sooner or later use it against its own citizens? The third thing you do is you create a paramilitary force not answerable to the people. In Italy, these were black shirts. In Germany, brown shirts.
You're about to say it, but when I read your book, The End of America, I thought this was one of your best perceptions, because I sat there thinking about some of this stuff when I visited Germany for various cases, And I said, well, it's different because we don't have black shirts, we don't have brown shirts. And your answer was?
Blackwater, unfortunately.
Exactly.
Eric Prince, the CEO, has close ties to the Bush White House, and he handpicks mercenaries who were torturers and murderers in their own countries, and countries that do torture and murder their own civilians, Chileans, Nigerians, you know, Pinochet's guys.
And then you coupled that, as I recall, with saying, you know, some people say, well, that's overseas, don't worry about it. But your point is, overseas will happen in America.
It's happening in America, in that case,
in the case of Blackwater, you point to New Orleans.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, Jeremy Scahill reported this very fully. Blackwater contractors were deployed in New Orleans in the wake of Hurricane Katrina, and there are reports of contractors shooting unarmed civilians. Now, Blackwater's business plan calls for increased deployment in the United States. They've got a base now in Illinois. They're trying to open a base in San Diego, and their website calls for monitoring, overseeing, engaging in controlling populations in Midtown Manhattan. So it's very scary, and if that wasn't scary enough, since I wrote the book, the 1st Brigade has been redeployed from Iraq to somewhere in the United States of America, 3,000 to 4,000 battle-hardened warriors in violation of Posse Comitatus and the Insurrection Act. And, you know, the day after Obama was elected, two more brigades were redeployed. And as I understand it, nothing prevents the executive from redeploying 10 brigades or 20 brigades. Very terrifying. We'll get to that. It's part of step 10. The fourth thing you do is create a surveillance apparatus aimed at ordinary citizens. That freaked me out in particular because I found myself on the watch list when I flew for a year and a half. Every time I flew, the quadruple S. And many, many critics of the administration were getting the quadruple S. And unfortunately, the guy who wrote Confessions of an Economic Hitman, John Perkins, who knows this world, he told me to talk about this in public, but my mail started arriving opened, ripped right open, and my tax returns, registered mail, disappeared from my mailbox. And, you know, other important documents disappeared. My daughter's letters, all her letters from camp, vanished. This sounds paranoid and crazy, but I've talked to other activists like Mark Crispin Miller, who documented vote fraud. He also experienced mail tampering. It's not like American doesn't have a history of this kind of harassment. Do I know who did it? No, I don't. I have no evidence at all. But the post office said this is not possible. So that's a tangent. But many activists are reporting, you know, MoveOn assumes that all their emails are read, all their phone calls are listened to. Lawyers are being eavesdropped on.
We have a lawsuit because all our lawyers who are in contact with, quote, alleged terrorist families in Europe and Pakistan and Middle East, they're all wiretapped. There's no doubt. It's 100%.
Which is horrific. Right. And it's not just, I don't think it's just the issue of the content. It's the way it affects you. I find that it has a really corrosive effect personally.
Our lawyers have to fly to the Middle East to have a conference with a family member because they can't trust the phone lines or the email.
Unbelievable.
So that's what happens.
Unbelievable. The fifth is that you see arbitrary detention and release of citizens, like James Yee, the Guantanamo chaplain. The sixth step is that you start to see infiltration and harassment of citizens' groups, like the kind of infiltration.
I want to stay on that one for a moment. The infiltration one is interesting because what's happened, as we've seen post 9/11, is we had FBI guidelines that restricted the FBI that were heavily fought for during the 70s and the 80s and even into the 90s. And then the first thing that happened when Ashcroft took office, he started to modify them. He took away the criminal predicate so you could go and do it without a criminal predicate. And then what they've done recently, and they've done it with regard to informants and infiltration, a few weeks ago, they said on new Bush guidelines that you could use race and ethnicity, essentially, to begin an investigation, and you could put informants into any group you wanted.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
The seventh step is that you start to see individuals being targeted for penalties like career setbacks or smears for criticizing the regime. People like Valerie Plame loses her job. Dan Rather loses his job for
those
a critical
report. Those are
both
very good examples, actually.
Yeah. The eighth step is you start to see restrictions of the press. Things like Josh Wolf, no relation, a blogger in San Francisco who was in federal prison for 7 months.
We interviewed him on this show. He's a heroic
kid.
Isn't he
great?
Oh, my God. Remember that? Yeah. The videotape. you had him in the movie
In
also,
the movie,
right?
Yeah. Okay. He's a wonderful presence and a real inspiration. The ninth thing you start to see is increasing, you know, language and legislation that recasts criticism as espionage and dissent as treason. So you start to see verbal charges like, you know, if you criticize the war, Hillary Clinton is committing treason or Obama is committing treason. But you start to actually see legislation like H.R. 1955, which thankfully hasn't passed the Senate yet, as I understand, but is terrifying if you get what it's really saying. It's modeled, I think, on Nazi law because they had very similar legislation, increasingly criminalizing speech and thought. And as I often tell my audiences, H.R. 1955 is so loosely worded that it would make listening to this broadcast an offense or engaging in this broadcast.
And we've looked at that. I always forget the name. It's like called the Violent Radicalization Act or something like that. And it really is it's an act about thought and speech.
Yes, it is.
And it had setting up these commissions around the country that are then going to look into where there's militant or radical speech. Right. It passed the House overwhelmingly, like 400 something to like six. I mean,
which is one note of, I think, you know, while we're talking about these threats, I do like to see where there are victories. And I have to say, so many, the mainstream media did not report on H.R. 1955 at all, but ordinary people alerted each other. And I think ordinary people screamed and yelled at their congresspeople, and I believe that that's held it back from becoming the law of the land. So when people wake up, there's a lot that, you know, they can do to stop these kinds of erosions. Then the last step is where we were at, you know, right before the election, and we're not backed off entirely from it now, and that is step 10, which is subverting the rule of law and making it easier to declare martial law. And that's when you start to see the way the White House was relating to Congress for the last 8 months or so, where Congress would, you know, present a law and the president would issue a signing statement, or Congress would say, we need to see those two destroyed tapes of al-Zubaydah being waterboarded. That's evidence of a crime. And they would say, whatever, we're not going to give them to you. Or they would say, we're subpoenaing Josh Bolton and Harriet Miers. And Congress would say, and the White House would say, too bad.
The ultimate arrogance was when Cheney told Leahy to F you.
In so many words?
He used, I can't say it on the air, but we know what we're talking
about.
Right. And that was the executive telling the legislature and putting him in his place.
Yeah, I'm sure you're right. And you saw this, it's a total replay. I think people very high up in the administration have studied fascism and totalitarianism. It's Condoleezza Rice's specialty. I think Karl Rove has a deep interest in the era. I have to say, as a matter of historical record, Prescott Bush, George Bush's grandfather, affiliated with the Nazis and was part of an attempted coup. This is actually fully documented in the 30s of industrial leaders who didn't like the New Deal and who admired what was happening in Italy and Germany and sent an agent over to learn about it and then tried to do the same thing in the U.S. It was thwarted by a war hero named Smedley Darlington Butler, and this is all in the congressional record. But I have no evidence that I have no smoking gun, but the echoes are extraordinary. In this case, you look at Italy in 1920, there were 6 months when the parliament kept acting like the parliament and Mussolini would just ignore them, you know, and ignore them and ignore them. And then there was the March on Rome. So the other scary developments in step 10 are forms of legislation like the Defense Authorization Act of 2007 that lets the president say it's a national emergency. Just because he says so, it makes it one, you know, magical powers. And then deploy, well, at that time, he could deploy the National Guard from Alabama to New York over the objections of both governors to create martial law. And now he actually has his own military. And so just to conclude the full circle and then get to hopefully what we can do, or what still needs to be done, what is absolutely terrifying to me, I think we all have our greatest fears in this list, and they're probably come from our personal experience. To me, I'm most scared of Blackwater when it was just Blackwater, and now I am absolutely terrified of the deployment of the military. That's one thing that I have gotten a lot of criticism for. It's interesting. Well, some of the mainstream media Like the Today Show had me on just to rip me apart when I said I was concerned about the deployment of the 1st Brigade.
That's very odd because, you know, when I think about this, one of my arguments always is whatever we think of the cops, good and bad, and they violate the law a great deal, they're trained in constitutional rights. They're trained not to shoot first. They're trained to use the least excessive amount of force. Whether they always go there is another question. Mm-hmm. Military people, brigades, Blackwater, as we know and as we've seen, they're trained to shoot first. They're not trained in constitutional rights. That's not what it's about. So it's very dangerous to have the military in the U.S.
And also the police are accountable.
That's
exactly
true.
Corporal David Antoon, one of my sources, confirmed. I interviewed David Antoon. And because of my study of history, what am I scared of? The precedent historically is that always when the military is deployed domestically, they're deployed against voters and opposition leaders, especially in a closely fought election. And so my fear was, you know, NORTHCOM's initial stated mission was the 1st Brigade is here to, quote, subdue unruly individuals and engage in, quote, crowd control. Well, we were running right up to an election that we knew was going to be close with a lot of theft. And so my worry was voters show up, they're not on the rolls, they're upset, they're, quote, unruly individuals. They are agents provocateurs because we know that agents get dressed like whatever, create situations of violence. And then the 1st Brigade is called in, or a declaration of martial law. I was sincerely scared about that. I said to Major Antoon, what happens if, and what people don't understand, and I didn't either, is the 1st Brigade isn't answerable to the people. They're not answerable to Congress. The National Guard are answerable to Congress or the governors. That's why we, you know, the founders had this beauty that, you know, a well-regulated militia is answerable to the people because they knew what a standing army can do to a population from their own experience of King George's mercenaries, right, and King George's soldiers. So the 1st Brigade is President Bush's army, and now it's going to be Barack Obama's army and any president in the future. And I said, well, if the president says to the 1st Brigade, arrest those civilians, what happens? He says they have to do it. And I said, if he says shoot those civilians, what happens? He said they have to do it. And I said, and if other senior military say disobey those orders, what happens? He said they get arrested. And I said, well, if they tell the 1st Brigade to arrest Congress people, what happens? He said they have to do it. This is a war hero. You know, this is a guy who fought and served, you know, his country and is a deep patriot. He said, the 1st Brigade can drive a tank down a street in Washington, D.C. and take out the Washington Times or the Washington Post with a shell and say that they were aiming at something else, like they did with Al Jazeera in Baghdad.
In the Palestinian Hotel.
And then I turn to you, Michael, because nobody believed me, right? And so I have to get validation or at least be told I'm wrong by the greatest minds in the land. So I said, Michael, the global war on terror rationale is that the whole world is a battlefield, right? Well, if the whole world is a battlefield, how is the U.S. not a battlefield? And if there's military on our soil, what prevails, military law or civilian law? And I wanted you to say that's a crazy question. And you didn't say that that was a crazy question. You said that those are the questions we need to ask.
No, those are the questions. And we think about this with some of our clients. Maher Arar, the man who was sent to Syria, he got off the plane at Kennedy. The question you have to ask is, could, if there were military people at the airport, they thought he was Al-Qaeda, could he have been shot on the spot as he got off the plane? Jose Padilla, when he got off the plane in Chicago, military people at the airport, so-called dirty bomber, could he have been shot at the airport? And I can tell you this, if he had been shot by the military at the airport, I'm willing to bet it would have been the same justification. You know, we're in the military. These are right. Al-Qaeda people. We've been told we can target Al-Qaeda people, and that's it. So it's a serious threat. So those are the 10 steps. I think they're really enlightening for people to look at those and their echoes. And now I think rather than go to the movie next, I want to end on the movie. Let's talk about what you can do because your book, sure. Give Me Liberty, which has a great title, it's called Give Me Liberty, A Handbook for American Revolutionaries, which is a fabulous title. You can go through the table of contents and really get a sense of being active. You know, I gave a talk at the center yesterday to about 40 people. They said, what do you think of this period? I said, well, I'm energized because I actually think maybe we can change some things. And they said, well, you know, you feel that way, Michael, because you're a lawyer and you're litigating these cases and you're writing about all these issues. But we feel a little bit helpless on this. And we understand we can do something, but what can we do? And so why don't we start from there, Naomi, and lay out what this book tells people, because it is an amazing handbook. It's about 350 pages long, but it's written in a way that I think a lot of people can understand. Again, called Give Me Liberty. I would recommend really everybody, so I don't get asked the question every time, Michael, what can we do? You can just read Naomi's book.
Naomi. Well, thank you, Michael. Well, I pretty much wrote it because that was the same question I was getting. You know, understandably, people who heard me talk about the 10 steps said, okay, we're persuaded. What do we do?
Right.
And so I needed quickly to write a sequel with the answer. And I didn't know the answer at the time because I, like most Americans, felt frustrated and helpless and powerless. I mean, what really struck me, we were talking about the state of the people I've met. What struck me traveling the country that led me to want to write Give Me Liberty is that audiences of Americans seemed to feel more depressed in the sense of hopeless about being able to make change, and like they had no authority and they couldn't make a difference, more depressed than audiences I've spoken to in baby democracies like Sierra Leone. I went back, just like I had studied closing societies to identify the 10 steps, I went and looked at how people dismantle tyranny and win back a republic. So I saw tactics that always work there. And I also went back to our founders. And by that, I don't mean just the well-known propertied white men whose names we're all familiar with, but there were some remarkable historians I drew on who have established that the nation was really birthed and this idea of liberty was brought forward by absolutely ordinary people, farmers, artisans, working people, washerwomen, enslaved Africans, African Americans, all of whom were captivated by this vision of liberty. And really, you know, in some ways, Jefferson and Franklin were kind of capturing what was in the air. But these people put their lives on the line, and then they were a founding generation who behaved in certain ways to set our nation in motion that we need to emulate. And they meant to bequeath us with these core American values. Now, we need those core American values in order to fight this fight and to snap out of our depression. So what I learned, not just from their example, but from looking at what they intended us to have, is that we've been kind of brainwashed over not just the last 8 years where it was intense, but 30 years of a systematic effort on the part of vested interests to get us to forget our leadership role as citizens and get us to forget the gifts of liberty and the toolkit of liberty that we're supposed to have. So right now, we are pretty much given the message that, well, you're exerting your role as a citizen or as a, you know, participant in democracy by voting and calling your congressperson. This is nonsense. When I learned more about what we're expected to do,
really
we're expected to lead the nation, you know, and we're expected to have a whole arsenal of tools at our disposal that I learned have been stripped of us for 30 years. So there's a section called Fake Patriotism where I talk about the, you know, false ideology that has been beamed at us for 30 years to get us to misidentify patriotism as, for instance, unthinking support for government or for the military, when the Declaration of Independence and other core texts identify American patriotism as being willing to overthrow the government or rise up against the government to dismantle tyranny and oppression every time it raises its head. I talk about how those kinds of very radical values have been suppressed and
that's
hidden.
Fabulous.
Nobody,
I mean,
teaches you that in eighth
no
grade.
One teaches it to you, and even when you do it from like our crowd. Anyway, that's the beginning of this chapter of the book, which I love. And then you go to actually sort of what I would call the toolkit part,
right.
The user's guide.
Right.
It's really how to do things, and it has such practical titles as how to petition, how to become the media yourself. Why don't you talk a little bit about what you see when you get the question, what can I do that's different? And that's what's really interesting, because the most I usually say is, oh, call your congressman.
Right.
And you're saying that's not enough.
There's so much more we're supposed to do. And I didn't even know before I basically went to experts like Heidi and the Center for Constitutional Rights and the National Lawyers Guild and got the best minds to tell us exactly how to seize back the power as citizens. The message I totally categorically got from the founding generation is that we are supposed to take over the power and not leave it to the pundits to have the debates, not leave it, with all due respect, to the constitutional scholars about the Constitution, not leave it to politicians to run the country, that we're supposed to do it. So there are these 55 action steps, and it's everything from, this is like the DNA of change, and I got this from Curtis Ellis, who works on the Hill and elects congresspeople. just calling your congressperson isn't enough. You can form yourself into democracy commando teams of 20 to 30 people and strategically intervene in the congressional election cycle so that you have more power than lobbyists and special interests when you then go to the district office and ask your congressperson to support your goals. You can stop complaining about the media and become the media. I teach people how to write their own op-eds, submit their own op-eds, leak to reporters what's on background, what's off the record, how to frame the debate, how to do radio, how to do television, how to write a press release. You want to start your own organization? Here's how you raise money. Here's how you start a 501c3. You want to start your own political movement? Here's how to do it. Start a blog. Start a video blog. Run for office. All of these things are things we're supposed to do. And what I have found is that when people know how to do these things, and this is, again, tools and information that I think is deliberately kept out of ordinary people's hands. I mean, there's this one section called Fake Democracy that precedes this, where I try to use the powers and rights that Jefferson intended me to have as a citizen, and I keep running against a brick wall. People intuit that those brick walls are there, but I found out that there really is like a Potemkin village keeping us from engaging because they don't want us to engage. They want us to give up and leave the table. So this is how you don't just take back your seat at the table, you take back leadership of the whole damn country. And I propose some fairly radical things as well, like national constitutional amendment, which the founders allowed us to call for, which would drive a national referendum. Because referenda, it's only a national referendum, 24 states have referenda, that would allow the American people to get some kinds of legislation we're never going to get from a corrupt Congress in the lap of special interests, like capping emissions for climate control or campaign finance reform. And that would really break the stranglehold of the special interests and take power back to the people.
Naomi Wolf, author of Give Me Liberty, A Handbook for American Revolutionaries. Someone, Naomi, who's been an activist most of my legal life, for sure, you know, I still found this book great for me. I mean, it has lots of everything from petitions to how to form your own political group. And the one I'm just reading now is a chapter on civil disobedience. You call it direct action activism. Say a word about that, and then I want to go to your movie.
Sure. Well, one thing that was clear when I looked at how people break up tyrannies is that mass protest always works. Always, always. I mean, unless the leaders, like in Burma, Myanmar, are willing to, like, machine gun the protesters, it always works to have thousands of people in the street. But I also discovered that the kind of protest that always works is illegal pretty much all over the country now for a specific reason. There's been, you know, in America, it's extraordinary. I mean, the thing that broke up the Soviet Union, we are not allowed to do in the United States. There's been a 30-year process of over-permitticization. And I really have to give a shout out to the National Lawyers Guild for walking me through understanding this. And that's deliberate. To basically, when you go to a march these days and you feel like, well, I went from point A to point B and I feel like I didn't do anything, it's because you didn't do anything, because it's set great. Up not to be effective. The only protest that's effective is protest that stops traffic. And by definition, you can't get a permit if you're stopping traffic, if you're in the street. And what a successful protest always does is it stops business as usual, because like you see in Thailand right now, flights couldn't take off because thousands of human beings were on the street leading up to the airport. Or, you know, as in Estonia, in the Baltic states at the end of the 80s, they broke up the Soviet Union by standing, holding hands on a highway through three countries, stopping everything from happening.
That's one of the best lessons I've heard you say today. That's really important.
Thank you.
Because we go through the streets marching away.
It does nothing.
Nothing. Doing
nothing.
Anything.
So,
well,
Michael,
I would add one thing.
Yes.
I do think it does this one thing. And I remember the massive demonstrations that we built that helped stop the war in Vietnam in the 60s. And what it did was it showed us and each other how much strength we had.
That's true.
And that also translated into anti-war sentiment in the GIs over in Vietnam.
That's true.
And then the other thing I would add is that apart from getting a permit, 500,000 people constitute their own permit, and you should just take it into your own hands.
Thank you. So I think you just may have broken the law by saying that, or, you know, or let me rephrase that.
Michael will defend me.
what I mean to say is, as I understand it, lawyers cannot advise people to break the law, right? But I'm not a lawyer, so I can advise people to break the law. And while I believe in the rule of law, and there's a whole chapter on the rule of law, some laws are wrong, and the law that increasingly limits our First Amendment rights to petition and assemble to smaller and smaller units, especially here in New York City. The police in New York are armed with tasers, sergeants are, and tasers have killed 300 people. I'm much less likely to be brave enough to engage in civil disobedience and lie down in the street with 10,000 people in New York.
We just interviewed our co-host who comes up occasionally, Dalia Hashad. She works at Amnesty International, and she just issued the report on the killing since 2001 of 384 people, I think
it's
is the number, by tasers.
Oh, my God.
It's really shocking. That's one. And the other issue is, of course, just recently at the RNC, Republican National Convention in Minneapolis, they arrested seven people on charges of
terrorism. Exactly.
Because of dissent. So you're right that what's happening, the dissent in this country, it's actually physically terrifying, right. And it's mentally terrifying.
Right. And now it's legally terrifying.
Right,
I met the brother of one of those young people charged with terrorism, Monica Bickford, a young idealistic woman who used her First Amendment rights and is now facing $250,000 in legal fees and maybe years in prison.
Yeah.
So this is the model that's sweeping across the country. Where was the 1st Brigade? I've just found out that why was the Republican National Committee so militarized? And in our movie, you can see terrifying footage of these militarized movements of police against innocent protesters and civilians. The Army was advising them. And reporters have told me that contractors, unidentified contractors, were in Minneapolis intimidating people. It could be Blackwater. Who knows? American nationals, not American nationals. So this is the wave of the future. So we need also to legislate both on the city council level and the federal level that our police cannot accept Homeland Security money, that they cannot use tasers and rubber bullets and microwave technology that harms and wounds us, and that we need to roll back those tactics so that we can have free protest.
Now, before I go to your movie, again, we're talking to Naomi Wolf. Give Me Liberty is the handbook for revolutionaries, how to get back democracy, how to get back your rights. You made an intriguing statement, Naomi, about Obama. And because one thing people could say, well, this was all under Bush. It's
right.
Over. It's done.
Right.
And you said something that I think you should just repeat and emphasize a little bit and tell us about.
Sure. It's so important. I would like nothing more than to think, well, the knight on the white horse has arrived. I can go back to not worrying about this. It's not true. One crucial motivator for the shredding of the Constitution is money. All the Cold War weapons manufacturers have now shifted into surveillance and security technologies, and their lobbyists sit down with Homeland Security officials and write the laws. So they have a vested billions of dollars can be made in turning the U.S. and the rest of the world into a police state, and that pressure is not going away. So Barack Obama doesn't have the power to say to Boeing and Raytheon and AT&T, as we saw, too bad. I don't care about what you want me to do. Unless he has an organized mass of citizens, organized effectively, as I teach people to and you teach people to, push back. And I saw this again and again in presidential campaigns. I worked on two of them, and not doing fashion consulting, but strategy and message. But Al Gore wanted to give people good policies, but sometimes he couldn't because the Chamber of Commerce didn't want him to. And moms and dads, who would have benefited from work-family policies were not organized. And so we have to be Obama's backbone, in a sense. And finally, the founders knew that even the best-intentioned executive would not give away power if not forced to. I mean, that's the nature of power is to be abused if it is not checked. Barack Obama may find a way to restore some aspects of this shredded Constitution, but you'd have to be a masochist as a president not to be tempted to just wiretap your political opponent if that would help you strategize around them in a tightly contested election, or not intimidate your opposition by, making the kinds of threats against them that have been made against the opposition in this
regime. Well, I think that's a critical statement, that essentially the population is the backbone of what the next president can do. And I think we all see that. We see that in our work at the center and otherwise. Now, in our last few minutes, I want to ask you about the movie.
Sure.
First book was End of America. This book is Give Me Liberty. And in between, there's this movie that I saw the other day at the International, IFC, International Film Center. Although I know a lot of the material, I was incredibly moved by it. Tears sometimes, shock other times. But at the end, you're really worried. At the end of that film, that we're really on a very, very bad road here. And the movie has a lot of it goes through the 10 steps. It's wonderful. And why don't you tell us a little bit about what the reaction is? I should tell our listeners, the movie is playing around right now. It's at in New York. It's at the IFC for at least another week after this broadcast. Right. And it's playing around the country in various places.
It's called End of America.
It's called The End of America. People should go to it. It's been extended. It was only going to play for a week at the IFC. I went to one of the early performances, which was completely filled. And it's now extended not only one more week, but two more weeks.
That's right. And so, I should say that Michael is one of the stars, and so is Maria LaHood, one of the brave lawyers at the Center for Constitutional Rights, who's representing Maher Arar. Well, it's a wonderful film, but even more terrific is that if you care about these issues, you have a lot of power as a citizen to educate people. And one of the things you can do is go to myamericaproject.com or endofamericamovie.com and order a DVD or get one out of the library and do a screening yourself. Show it to your friends. Show it to your church or synagogue or mosque group. Show it to your reading group.
That's great.
You said
that
when we were there, but I didn't remember it, but it's great.
That's fine. And if you want, Simon and Schuster will yell at me, but if you want, at the back of Give Me Liberty, there's a Constitution and Bill of Rights that we've translated into ordinary English so that everyone can understand it. And you can Xerox that and pass it out to the people at your events, because our goal is for everyone in America to understand what the Constitution and the Bill of Rights has to say. So if you also want to roll back more of these laws and join this fight, you can also go to AmericanFreedomCampaign.org, which is a grassroots democracy movement that I co-founded, and there are concrete laws we need to pass to restore the Constitution. And again, I just want to say you've got to support CCR, NLG, and ACLU, as well as WBAI, as being, you know, really our leaders. Well, we're all leaders, but in the front lines of this fight.
Oh my gosh, you know, Naomi, I got through a lot of the book, but I didn't get through this chapter of putting into regular words the Constitution. It's fabulous. Congratulations.
Thank you. Well, I didn't do it. Two very wonderful lawyers who donated their time and expertise did it. But isn't it wonderful? Because it's hard to understand, not just if you're not a lawyer, but if you don't speak 18th century English.
So really, thanks to Naomi, we have an embarrassment of riches. The End of America, which was great. The film, which I recommend. And this book, which, even if you're an activist, I think is really helpful. It gives you an answer when you get those embarrassing moments after you talk. What can I do? And you just use BS and say, well, go call your congressman. Well, that's not enough or almost anything.
Thank you, Michael. And on a final note, I found that when people do get engaged in this powerful way, it makes them really happy and they make new friends and fall in love and gives new meaning to their lives. And the last thing I want to say is we didn't get a chance, I hope we will in the future, to talk about prosecutions. And that's the big fight for the future. And everyone who wants to know a critical thing to do, run out and read Michael's latest book, The Prosecution of Donald Rumsfeld, and lobby through these various organizations to get prosecutions going and get investigations and a truth commission, right?
Thank you. Thank you, Naomi.
Thank you, Naomi.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.